You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show, and wherever you are, welcome to it. There's been a lot written about Islam since 9/11. The Western world has awakened to the reality of a huge, huge world religion out there. Should have been aware of it, of course, for better and for worse. It's not just for worse, but for better as well, for a long time. But in any event, there was an awakening on 9/11. One of those to be writing on Islam and who has been critical is Robert Spencer, and he is my guest. Robert Spencer, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I appreciate it. Your latest book is Onward, Muslim Soldiers, How Jihad Still Threatens America and the West. What's your thesis?
The idea is that the Islamic faith is different from all other religions, and I demonstrate this in abundant detail from Islamic sources in the book. It's different from all other religions in actually having a developed doctrine, tradition, theology, and law that mandates violence against non-Muslims. Manuals of Islamic law carrying endorsements from the highest authorities in the Islamic world, they call on Muslims to wage war against non-Muslims until they either convert to Islam or submit as inferiors under Islamic rule, and that inferior status is very also defined in great detail in these manuals of Islamic law. Now, the point is not that all Muslims think this way or subscribe to these views. Obviously, many don't. But this is the justification that radical Muslims are using around the world, as I establish in the book, to recruit and motivate terrorists. And this is the problem that we have to face, that the source, really, ultimately, of radical, violent Islam is deeply rooted in Islamic tradition. It's not the only Islamic tradition, but because it is so well attested in the Islamic sources, it's very hard to root out. And we have to call upon Muslims worldwide to repudiate this jihad ideology and the dimitude, the second-class status of non-Muslims in Muslim society before we're going to see an ultimate end to this violence around the world.
Now, I'm trying to put myself in the place of a Muslim listening to you.
Sure.
What have you studied that gives you the authority to say this?
Well, I don't claim any authority to say this at all. In the book, I don't come to conclusions of my own, but merely report on what's being said in the Muslim sources. And so, for example, not only do you have the Quran, but you have the Hadith, which is Islamic tradition, the traditions of the Prophet Muhammad's words and deeds at the time that the Quran was being revealed to him. Those are many volumes, and there's an entire science in Islamic theology of separating the authentic from the inauthentic, but working entirely from ones that Muslims generally accept as authentic. You have the Prophet Muhammad saying that the Muslims should come to the non-Muslims and invite them to accept Islam, and if they accept, then to welcome them as brothers, but if they refuse, then to make war upon them, and to either then offer, if those that survive are then to be offered this second-class status under Islamic rule. This is in the Hadith, the traditions, this is in the Tafsir commentaries on the Quran, which I also examine in the book, which actually say that there are peaceful and tolerant verses in the Quran. There are also verses enjoining this kind of violence. But the Tafsir, many of the respected and still recommended commentators on the Quran, Muslim commentators, say that the violent verses actually cancel out the peaceful ones because they were revealed later, and that the violent verses are the Quran's last word on the subject, and thus the enduring responsibility of the Muslim world as a whole. And so these are not my conclusions. These things are from the sources themselves. I would invite anybody, Muslim or non-Muslim, reading who doubts this, to look at the book, to see the sources that I'm using to establish this, and to keep in mind, of course, that I'm not condemning all Muslims in the aggregate, or saying that all Muslims believe these things, but just merely trying to identify the sources of radical Islam and thus the things that need to be rooted out before radical Islam can be ultimately stopped.
In your read, is radical Islam a relatively new invention, or it is true to its sources?
It's a relatively new invention in one way, and that is relatively new. I mean 80 years. because in the 1920s, it was founded in Egypt, a group called the Muslim Brotherhood. And I profile the founder of it, Hassan al-Banna, in the book, along with an influential follower of his, Sayyid Qutb. These are the two of the leading intellectual theorists who formulated the radical Islam for the 20th century. And really, there, the Muslim Brotherhood can be directly traced, as I show in the book, to many of the radical groups around the world today that are on the State Department's terrorist list. The Hamas group in Israel explicitly says in its charter that it's an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas has direct connections with al-Qaeda. And there are Muslim Brotherhood offshoots in essence all around the world. But these men, when they formulated this ideology, and when they said that it was the responsibility of Muslims to wage war against non-Muslims and to wage war against any government that did not obey Islamic law, and this is the stated goal of radical Muslims around the world today, as I show in the book, to establish Islamic law everywhere possible, then they were actually drawing on earlier traditions and an entire legal system and doctrinal system in Islam. Once again, not the only one, but a strong one that they
were
able to...
So let me ask, there's a bottom line question here.
Yeah.
In your understanding, does Islam inevitably lead to this radical Islam make war upon the non-Muslim, or does it permit it, or is it a violation? There are three choices. It either enjoins it, or B, permits it, or C, does not want it, but some can wrench certain verses out of context. Which do you think it is?
Enjoins. It enjoins it, and I'll tell you why. There are teachers in the Islamic world, and I quote them in the book, who say that there were three stages in the development of the Quran's teachings on jihad. That first was revealed the idea that the prophet should preach to the people, the non-believers, and leave them alone if they didn't accept Islam. Second was enjoined the possibility that Muslims could defend themselves when attacked, and you hear many, even moderate Muslim voices, acknowledging that stage. The third stage, according to these sources, which range from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, Egypt notably, they also say that the third stage is actually the command to wage offensive war in order to spread the hegemony of Islamic law, and either to convert the people who they meet who are not Muslims, or to allow them to practice their religions under Islamic rule, but as second-class citizens, without the equality of rights and dignity that the Muslims enjoy. Now, this is something that's a deeply rooted tradition, as I say. It goes all the way back to statements of the Prophet and passages.
Right, then why do you say that it was what new was developed in the 1920s?
Oh, well, what you have in the 1920s is the application to the modern situation and the idea that that what the Muslims have to do. Well, in the first place, you have several things, actually, Dennis, and one of them is that in the 1920s, you have the Muslim world that's been colonized, and is in an inferior position itself economically and politically. And you have, in the first place, the formation of the Muslim Brotherhood and other movements like it in order to revive the Islamic world. And so it was a certain call back to some of the old-time religion aspects, some of these things that were saying, you know, we once had this glorious empire, and this is why we have to reassert it, but also an application of these traditional Islamic categories to the modern situation. Sayyid Qutb, who I mentioned before, one of these Egyptian theorists who is still revered today as a martyr, he was killed by executed by Nasser's government in Egypt in 1966, He said, look, communism has failed. He's writing in the 60s. Democracy has failed. These things, the world is looking for a new leadership. The world is looking for a new social paradigm. We have it. It is the moment for Islam to assert itself. And they call. And this is the cry, the call that the radicals have been using around the world. And they're able to say to Muslims who might have grown up in rather relatively secular contexts, that if you're going to be a loyal Muslim, if you're really going to be true to your religion, then you have to do these things. These are forgotten elements of our religion that we're trying to revive.
The book is Onward Muslim Soldiers, How Jihad Still Threatens America and the West, published by Regnery. And I am going to invite calls, especially from those who have any problem with anything you're hearing from Robert Spencer, and certainly from Muslim listeners. It's an indictment, and it's an important one to respond to. 1-8-PRAGER-776, and it's an important book to consult. Onward Muslim Soldiers, Robert Spencer. 1-8-PRAGER-776. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. My guest is Robert Spencer. Thank you, Sean, who has just published, actually Regnery has just published, he has just written, Onward Muslim Soldiers, How Jihad Still Threatens America and the West, his second book on Islam. The phone number here is 1-8-PRAGER-776. I have a lot of questions for you, but I do want to take some calls here. Let's go to Brooklyn, New York on 970-WWDJ. And Frida. Hello, Frida. Dennis Prager and Robert Spencer.
Hi, Robert Spencer. Frida.
Hello,
Saul. I was kind of curious because I've been doing a lot of reading on Islam, and I actually do have your book, and so I'm reading it.
Thank you. It's wonderful.
But I'm kind of curious why scholars like Bernard Lewis and Daniel Pipes have really kind of missed this line of reasoning that where we can see that these radicals really are tied into Islamic law and Islam itself.
Well, I think they're both well aware of it, and if you read their writings closely, you'll see that they are quite aware of the primary source material that I work with in the book to illustrate the fact that these things are so deeply rooted in Islamic law and tradition. I think that for various reasons of their own, they don't choose to emphasize it. Pipes obviously has said militant Islam is the problem and moderate Islam is the solution, and I actually agree entirely with that. What I'm doing is delineating the what moderate Muslims will actually need to reform in the religion if there's going to be real peace. And I'm not intending to dictate to them in doing that, but only to say that these are the sources of the problem. And thus, these are where what the solution must address if it's going to be a true solution. And I think that in terms of the specifics of what I'm saying, that there wouldn't be substantial disagreement with Dr. Pipes or Dr. Lewis. As a matter of fact, Dr. Pipes very warmly endorsed my new book. You can see his endorsement on the back cover.
Yeah, and that's important. 1-8-PRAGER-776, and thank you, Frida. Terry in Baltimore. Whoops, that was my mistake. It's line two. Back to Baltimore and Terry. Hello, Terry. Dennis Prager and Robert Spencer.
Well, good afternoon or good morning, or both.
Or both, right.
I have a question for Mr. Spencer.
Yes.
How would you distinguish Muslim militancy today from Jewish and Christian and Hindu militancy both today and in the past? In other words, what is different about Islam as opposed to, say, Christian militants who would use the scripture and find all the passages to justify their intolerance?
Yeah. Well, I thank you for the question. That's an important question. In the first place, I want to emphasize that in no way do I mean to minimize the atrocities that have been committed in the name of every religion on the planet. There's no indication that there's any religion that has never been used to justify acts of violence or hatred. That's not beyond dispute. However, the difference here is precisely in the doctrinal elaboration and justification that has been given to violence in Islam. As I say, the legal manuals of Islam tend to say, as I'm quoting from one right now, the caliph, that's the leader of the Islamic community. There's no caliph now, but that's another story. The caliph makes war upon Jews, Christians, and Zoroastrians until they become Muslim, or else pay the non-Muslim poll tax, the special tax on non-Muslims, the jizya. Now, the fact is there's no comparable doctrine no comparable legal stipulation in any other religion. You have the Pope in Christianity repudiating the Crusades, apologizing for the Crusades. You've never had a similar motion from the Muslim side of any repudiation of the theology and the laws underlying jihad, violent jihad, or any apology for the depredations of violent jihad throughout history. And that's the kind of thing we're going to need to see before there's really any progress, ultimately, in the war on terror.
Does that answer you, Terry?
Yes, it does.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Robert Spencer, many argue, and not just Muslims, but in fact, the anti-Israel chorus in the United States, that, the real problem is Israel, and if there were no Israel, then this Islamic hatred wouldn't be there.
Yes. Well, the fact is that the Islamic hatred is not limited in the least to Israel. It's an interesting thing that you say that, because I just recently I wrote an article about the Islamic justifications used for suicide bombing, and some people commented saying, no, it's all about land and Israel. But the fact is, suicide bombing is not just taking place in Israel. It's taking place in Russia and in Kashmir and in Indonesia, wherever there are these hot spots and where radical Islam is present, you find suicide bombing. And so that's just one indication of the fact that the parameters of radical Islam are much greater than the Middle East or the conflict with Israel, and their stated motivations and goals are quite different. And actually, while Israel plays a role in them, that's not in the least the only reason why these things are happening, and as I explain in the book.
All right, what about the argument that prior to Israel, Islam treated Jews beautifully?
Well, I think that's historically inaccurate, and that there's quite a few politically motivated distortions and whitewashes of history out there. But in fact, the legal system that I've alluded to several times already is the system of dimitude. That's the idea that...
Let me explain that to everyone. Dhimmi is D-H-I-M-M-I, and
yes,
that is the term for the people of the book who are not the monotheists, who are not Muslim.
Exactly. And they are given special status in Islamic theology and law. They're allowed to practice their religions, but it's decidedly with second-class status. And in the same Islamic legal manuals that I have referred to already, you find very carefully detailed laws regarding their second-class status. They have to, in the first place, pay this higher tax rate, the jizya, that Muslims do not have to pay. A lot of Muslim apologists say, well, yes, but Muslims have to pay the zakat, the charitable tax. But the fact is that that tax is delineated in Islamic law as redounding to the benefit of the soul of the believer, whereas the jizya is explicitly said to be part of the believer's humiliation. And in many places, it was actually accompanied, the collection of it. You couldn't just fill out a 1040. The collection of it was accompanied by an actual ceremony of humiliation that involved a blow to the head and shouting and so on. Also, non-Muslims are, and this is straight from the legal manual Umdat al-Saliq, which is, according to Al-Azhar University in Cairo, which is the most respected and influential university in the Muslim world, conforms to the orthodox faith and practice of the Sunni community. This says that non-Muslims must be distinguished from Muslims in dress, wearing a wide cloth belt. They are not to be greeted with assalamu alaikum, that's peace be with you, which is the standard greeting with which a Muslim greets another. They must keep to the side of the street. That is, if a Muslim's coming down the sidewalk, they have to get off the walk. They may
from
not
from when is that? From when,
than,
from when is this? Robert, from when is this?
This is from now. This is a legal manual that is contemporary.
From Al-Azhar.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the Vatican of Sunni Islam.
Exactly. And this is
all right, we'll be back in a moment. Let me tell everybody the name of your book, Onward Muslim Soldiers. Robert Spencer, you're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. The phone number is 1-8-PRAGER, P-R-A-G-E-R, 776, and I'm Dennis Prager. listening to the Dennis Prager Show. My guest is Robert Spencer, who has written his second book on Islam, is now out. Regnery Publishing is the publisher, and it's titled Onward, Muslim Soldiers, How Jihad Still Threatens America and the West. By the way, talking about your publisher, Mr. Spencer, is Regnery, which is a major publisher, and especially of conservative books.
Yeah.
Why do you think, or let me, I shouldn't say why, do you believe that a standard publisher would have published your book?
Well, I don't know. I really can't speculate on that because really Regnery was involved with this from the beginning. And
well, let me, the challenge is not to your book. The challenge is to publishers.
Yeah.
Why do you feel that, let's put it this way, it's inconceivable to me that Knopf, which largely publishes liberal books,
yeah,
and is a distinguished publisher, that they would have published your book or that Pantheon would have. Why do you think that what you're saying is not palatable left of center?
Well, I tell you, I don't think that it... I think that that's a shame in the first place, because I think that what I'm talking about is a human rights issue that ought to be of concern to everyone with any kind of a concern for human rights. After all, Islamic law, which the radical Muslims want to institute wherever they can around the world, Islamic law explicitly denies equality of rights to women and to non-Muslim minorities. That being the case, this ought to be something that Knopf or some other publisher...
Oh, I couldn't agree more. So what is your theory?
Well, I think that it's perceived as being somehow... Well, you know, I'll tell you what. The American Muslim advocacy groups have had great success in posing as neutral civil rights organizations despite abundance of evidence to the contrary. And they have been able to smear as bigotry any kind of honest examination of the roots of terrorism in Islam. And so these people are afraid of being called bigots. They're afraid of offending the multiculturalist ethos. They're afraid that they will be seen as intolerant or something of that kind. When that's why, once again, I'm very careful to work from Muslim sources alone, so that any reader of goodwill who picks up Onward Muslim Soldiers will see that I'm simply laying out what the Muslim sources say. And
all right, fair enough.
Any hate in this book comes from them, not from me.
Denver, Colorado, KNUS, Carl. Hello, Carl Dennis Prager, Robert Spencer.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I have a question. This is I really appreciate what you're saying.
Thank you.
And because I think it's honest, and there's not only ignorance but dishonesty in so much of the public debates over Islam. By the way, I'm a college professor, and I teach a course called The Clash of Civilizations.
Oh, that's
terrific. I take the title from Huntington's book. And I guess what I'm asking you is, do you really have the courage to carry through the conclusion your own premises? Because if indeed this is based on deep Islamic tradition, in fact, going back to the Quran, the Hadith, and so forth, which I agree with, by the way, is moderate Islam really the solution? I think you're waffling there.
Well, no, I'm not, because I'm talking about a moderate Islam that has to repudiate jihad ideology once and for all, very clearly, that has to take legal manuals like the ones that I've been referring to and say, this has been Islamic doctrine, this has been the cause of great violence and suffering, and we repudiate it explicitly and finally. You don't find moderate Muslims, so-called nowadays, saying that. On the contrary, you find a lot of people who say Islam is a religion of peace, and it's always been a religion of peace. And anybody who says otherwise is just a hate monger, and they just gloss over or ignore or actually deny the existence of the evidence that I bring forth in the book. What we need instead is moderate Muslims who are willing to acknowledge that it is there. Just like, I mean, that would be like the Pope saying that.
All right, here's the question.
Apologizing for that.
Right, here's the question. Lord Cromer, the British viceroy in Egypt in the 19th century, said, yeah, Islam reformed is Islam no longer. Is the Islam that you are speaking of, do we have models of it?
Models of it? No, we have individuals, really, but we don't have models of it. I mean, this is an unpleasant fact. But I think that it's not necessarily so that because it's never happened, it cannot happen yet. You know, the Reformation happened in Christianity. There was no parallel for it in history. And so this is the kind of thing we need to see in Islam.
An Islamic Reformation.
Yes, nothing less.
I'm sorry to say, but I agree. I think we do need an Islamic Reformation, and that is no more anti-Muslim than to say that the Protestant Reformation means that that you welcome that means you're anti-Catholic.
Exactly.
1-8-PRAGER-776 is the number. The book is Onward Muslim Soldiers. The author is Robert Spencer. And you can also email me through DennisPrager.com. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. Phone number is 1-8, that's the number 8, 1-8-PRAGER-776. My guest is Robert Spencer, whose most recent book is Onward Muslim Soldiers, and the question is, what are the roots, if there are roots, or is it entirely a perversion of Islam, the current terror and the war against Christians in many countries where Christians and Muslims live together, like the Philippines and Nigeria? Or is there a normative basis for all of this in Islam itself? And you are arguing from Islamic sources that this is quite normative. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
How do you react when the president says that this is all a perversion of Islam?
Well, I think that the president is not a theologian, and the president is not an Islamic scholar. And so he's working from political reasons, some of which I believe are pretty clear on the face of things, that he's trying to avoid there being a war with the entire Muslim world and trying to pour cold water on the radical Muslim voices that are saying that this is a war with Islam and that Muslims must wage jihad against the Americans to defend Islam. That being the case, I think he could have accomplished that without saying anything. As Pat Robertson pointed out, he's not the chief theologian of the United States, and it probably would have been better just to keep silent on this issue.
Well, as you say, whether he believes it or not, the fact is he feels politically constrained not to fuel more anti-American sentiment in the world's billion Muslims.
And I'm 100% behind him on that. I just don't think that it's ultimately productive to buy into these kinds of whitewashes and distortions, because they are being exploited by many Muslims in the United States to impede efforts in the war on terror. The American Muslim advocacy groups like the Council on American Islamic Relations and others, two employees of the Council on American Islamic Relations have recently been arrested for on suspicion of terrorist activities. And the fact is that this is anything but a neutral group, but it is routinely treated as such in the press.
It's astonishing, actually.
They have a lot of influence in the White House.
Yeah, that's right. That is astonishing. That whole issue needs to be aired more, but we'll keep to this. Sophia in Seattle, Washington on KKOL. Dennis Prager and Robert Spencer, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Sophia.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to comment. Your guest had made some comments about how people of other faiths and women are not treated equally under Islam, right? And he doesn't tell you that there are, I'm sure he knows there are four major schools of interpretation in Islam.
Yes, actually, and I treat them all in the book. I assume you're talking about the four madhabs, the schools of jurisprudence in Islam, the Shafi'i, Maliki, Hanafi, and Hanbali. They all teach the same things about this and about the denial of equality of rights to non-Muslims under Islamic rule. Obviously, these laws are not in effect in the Islamic world universally today, but this is what radical Muslims are trying to establish around the world today, the restoration of precisely these laws.
Yeah, I would have to disagree with that. I'm a Muslim, and I know that these four schools, that's why there are four different schools. They do not agree on these issues.
Specifically,
so I think you should be more honest in that not all Muslims have this interpretation.
Right, I said that. But,
right, and so
the fact
and,
is that the schools of law do indeed agree on the rules for the dhimmis, and I would invite you to look at the book. And
yeah, but they don't agree on the application of how one would go about that.
Yeah, the application can vary. The application is varied widely in history, but there's no place in history or in the modern world where Islamic law is enforced today where you find that non-Muslims and Muslims live as fully equal citizens.
Yeah, of course.
And that,
but,
that's
I mean, they're not.
Problem.
They're not. It isn't. It's not to say that the like Jews are treated horribly or the Christians are treated horribly.
Well, I think that the lack of equality of rights and dignity is horrible enough in itself, even in the absence of violent persecution. It's not something that is compatible with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights or similar documents. And as a matter of fact, out of the Islamic world, there have come several critiques of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, taking issue with it on the basis of precisely these points, the equality of rights and dignity for all, and the freedom of people to change their religion.
Sophia.
Because, of course, in Islamic law, you have the death penalty for anybody who leaves Islam.
Yeah.
Yeah, and we have different interpretations on that as well.
Yes.
Right, but his argument is that wherever it's enforced Islamic law, none of the moderate interpretations prevail. That's what he's raising. Do you feel that's incorrect, Sophia?
Well, it's only Islamic law is only like used in certain countries.
Right. So, well,
right.
Fair enough. But wherever it is used, none of the moderate interpretations prevail.
I couldn't say that on a whole. Yeah, Saudi definitely, but as far as Iran and Pakistan, I don't have much knowledge of how they implement.
They sentenced
their
laws. The man to death for converting to Christianity, and they sentenced the Christian to death for converting a Muslim in Pakistan last year.
Yeah, this is very common in Pakistan. The Christians are having a terrible time there. Also in Egypt.
Well, again, yeah, maybe you are right that they're using that. One interpretation, that's an interpretation. Some scholars differ on
right,
on
so
that.
What you're saying, Sophia, is that there is a possibility of a moderate Islam governing, and so is Robert Spencer, and he hopes that it will happen. But it hasn't.
Right, exactly. Right.
That's so, really, there isn't much of a difference, thank God, between the two of you. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
All right, appreciate it. Let's see here. Okay, 1 second. I know what I did. All righty, let's go over to another Muslim, Comer, in Atlanta, Georgia. Comer, Dennis Prager, hi.
Hi, how are you?
How are you? Thank you.
I'm fine. Well, I know none of the Muslim leaders have, they're not united to begin with.
Yes.
They will not apologize till they are united, but I, as a ordinary Muslim, on behalf of peaceful Muslims, do apologize for all the sins and terrorism that Muslims commit on a regular basis.
Comer, you stay on with me, okay? I'm not letting you go. I just want to. I want to give
a sign of hope.
Yeah, I do. I want to give you some more time. We'll be back in a moment. The book is "Onward, Muslim Soldiers," and it certainly seems to me that you have mastered a good deal about Islam, Robert Spencer.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome very much. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. 1-8-PRAGER-776. Listening to the Dennis Prager Show, and I thank you for doing so. The book is "Onward, Muslim Soldiers." This man sounds like he knows what he's talking about in measured tones, but he is raising what I believe are the most important issues facing the world today in his book, "Onward, Muslim Soldiers." And we are back to Comer, who is a Muslim listener in Atlanta, Georgia. And I thank you, Comer. Hi.
Hi.
So you were. By the way, are you American born?
No, I'm not. I'm a Pakistani born.
You're Pakistani born. And do you practice Islam?
I try to, yes.
Yeah. So 5 times a day do you pray? I'm not checking up on you. I'm just curious to know, of course, you know.
These days I am trying to, and yes, I do.
And you fast during Ramadan?
Yes.
And do you feel that the Quran is the revealed word of God?
I do.
Okay, good. So then it's particularly important to hear from you. Go ahead.
Yes, and I consider myself a fundamentalist Muslim because I try to stick to the fundamentals and try to go back to the source.
Then how do you, how do you react to what you hear from Robert Spencer?
Well, he said that I agree that we need a reformation of Islam all over the world, a modernization. And he said that we are the history is being whitewashed, and I agree with that. Also, on the other side of the fence within Islam, there has been some whitewashing, and some of the interpretations and quotations are coming from that. My question to Robert is, can he give examples of terrorism or from the life of the Holy Prophet or how he led his life? Because that is my first guiding light.
Yeah, well, that's a very important question. And in the first place, the easy answer is no, because terrorism is a modern concept. There was no such thing as terrorism in the 7th century. Nobody was committing what anybody was calling terrorist acts. Okay. But what you do have in the life of the Prophet is a pattern of offensive warfare, the raids on the other the Quraysh and the other tribes in the area, the the battles that he fought against non-Muslims, and the high value that he placed on jihad. These things are all being used by radical Muslims today, and his example is held up and used to justify terrorist acts. And it's very difficult because 7th century warfare, everybody fought in a particular in a wild, no holds barred kind of way that nowadays people would repudiate, at least in theory. But when you transpose that 7th century example to the 21st century, then it looks very different. And therein lies the problem.
Well, thank you, Comer. I wish we had more time with you. I can only say, I think on behalf of Robert Spencer, that you are the hope of humanity.
Yes.
Robert Spencer, good luck to you. You have really mastered, to my mind, the great question facing humanity today.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
You're welcome. Good luck on your book, Onward Muslim Soldiers. To Abel, Kathy, Andy, and the others who just hung up, I'm sorry I didn't get to you. Don't go away. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show.